Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 23 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast, the third of season 3. This one is all about Zalman the Vicious, King of Anarquist. With this episode, we're fully into the Nightmare Years, the most dire times in the history of Anarquist, the most famous realm in the entire world below the War in the Heavens. And let's see how Zalman, who reigned from 372 to 385, the son of Grippina the Cruel, handles taking over from his notorious mother. He had the nickname of Zalman the Vicious, so that might give you a clue, and he was said to be meaner than a junkyard dog. Overview. Succeeding a notoriously cruel and bloody despot can be a challenge, not only because of the built-up rage and resentment and desire for revenge. So Zalman had a job on his hands when his mother died in 372, and the crown was his at the age of 50. This meant that he wasn't a callow youth or unprepared for the role, at least. His reign was marked by an interest in magic and in weaponry, often both together. Shadowy influences were controversial, but there were no serious challenges to his rule, not a single one. He died in 385 at the age of 63 in an unfortunate encounter with deadly local wildlife. The early years. He was born in 322, and he spent most of his latter childhood and young adulthood in a fort on the western border of Anarquist, after his mother, Queen Grippina, in 350, decided Zalman and his two older siblings would be far better off at a distance from the capital. Some people would have called it paranoia if they had had that term back then, but Queen Grippina was merely assuming that her offspring might be like her and plotting an overthrow. To her mind, most probably, she was being kind by effectively exiling them instead of executing them. This fort is in the area where the town of River Bend is in the present day. Zalman, being the oldest, chafed most at the confines of the border fort, but stayed while the commander, a veteran named Calchas Sumo, who Zalman generally referred to with gruff praise, taught the royal siblings some practical skills in soldiering, far removed from the niceties they'd been trained in while at the palace. When Zalman left the fort at the age of 18, he went to Jalox and joined a notorious mercenary crew, the Indispensables. It was one of the mercenary armies his father had served time with, and Zalman put many of the lessons he'd learned from Calchas Sumo into good effect. In the next decade he was with them, he rose to command a company, some 200 soldiers. Leaving the Indispensables on good terms, he returned to Anarquist, but not to the palace, which might tell us something about his relationship with his mother. While just about every member of the Anarquist family has been excellent at holding a grudge, Zalman took this to another level. Being cast out from the family, the palace, and the centre of culture and society as he had been, he held it against Queen Grippina for the rest of her life, while being careful not to do anything that would stoke her renowned rage and have him executed. Instead, he kept his distance and maintained a cool, formal relationship with the person who was, after all, going to hand him the crown. At the Miro Naval Academy, he learned sailing and maritime warfare. Despite being in his late 30s at the time and an experienced infantry commander, he went back to basics and learned with the novices, hauling on anchor chains with the rawest of them. His land-based military expertise was recognised, however, and he was quickly recruited to help train naval crew in weaponry of various sorts, helping improve the tactics of boarding parties from a madcap frontal rush to something more calculated. With this combined background of both land and maritime martial skills, Zalman was in a good position to exert control when the time came. In 362, Agrippina made a public announcement about the succession, confirming what she had already laid down to her children. The declaration, where she didn't just designate her heir, but her three other children would follow Zalman, no matter what, caused some consternation in Anacust. When I say some consternation, I really mean a couple of whispers in dark corners when the whisperers were sure they wouldn't be overheard, and even then they had palpitations. Agrippina's rule being Agrippina's rule and all that, when dissent was a quick road to a bloody end. Zalman must have bitten his tongue, something he must have been good at, having survived so long under the gaze of his mother. On the one hand, he was going to be king. Good stuff. But the right every other Anacustian monarch had had, the right to anoint their own heir, was effectively being taken away from him by his mother's proclamation. It wasn't just breaking with tradition. This attempt at ruling beyond the grave was undermining the rights of the absolute monarch. It's enough to say that when Queen Agrippina died in 372, Zalman wasn't the only one who shed few tears. His rule was just as stern as that of his mother, and he too brooked no dissent. Executions were many, reprisals few, mostly because very few dared to go up against such a brutal ruler. He made public executions a regular event and demanded attendance from all nobles as a show of their loyalty, even when the condemned was a member of their own family. He also built an arena and implemented gladiatorial combat as well as spectacles of the cruelest sort. Initially, King Zalman had a circle of friends, cronies, call them what you will, that he advanced far beyond their capabilities until he tired and rid himself of most of them by insisting that they fight in the arena. The bodyguard of Queen Agrippina easily transferred its loyalty to her son, who formalised them into what became the Palace Guard that endures today in Anacust, an elite company with the sole loyalty to the monarch, not to the nation. Reign highlights. Magic and the potent edge. Midway through his reign, Zalman's approach to ruling diverged somewhat from his mother's. Whereas she had little to do with magic, preferring more concrete methods of creating terror, he fairly and squarely gave it his attention. It's unclear whether Zalman had long harboured an interest in magic, or whether it was prompted by the approach of the individuals who soon became his closest advisers. But in 378, he appointed three shadowy magic practitioners to what became known as the Potent Edge. The Potent Edge was an advisory body with sweeping and undefined powers. It had three members, all extremely proficient wielders of magic, and since King Zalman had access to the vast supply of highly powerful heavenly scales from the Anacustian Heavenfall, they were in a very fine position indeed. Soon, those who had the misfortune to be on the outer with King Zalman began to suffer not just straightforward torture, but torture magically mediated. A horrible fate indeed. On the advice of the Potent Edge, King Zalman ordered that the Hypogeum turn all its efforts towards martial magic, magic that would assist an army in battle, and as a result, promising areas of magic research outside that narrow field had progress put back for decades. In addition, several darker, more horrible areas were said to be encouraged by the Potent Edge, much to the shame and horror of the scholars in the Hypogeum. The identity of the three members of the Potent Edge was never made public, and the trio disappeared on the death of King Zalman. King Zalman and the military. Zalman had a desire for expansion, and to this end conquered Tinland in 374. He commanded in the field and was known as a fierce and skillful fighter. He had a reputation for the red haze, berserker-style loss of control, and was rumoured to have mutilated corpses of the fallen. Several members of his personal guard also died in odd circumstances, and flanking the king became a muttered synonym for foolish and suicidal behaviour in battle. He also had little time for prisoners and paying ransom, overturning what had been to that time a tradition. If captured, even nobles could expect to die a horrible death at the hands of King Zalman and his soldiers. With his background, it was no surprise he was a supporter of the Anacustian navy and steered funds its way, enough to increase the size of the fleet by nearly 50%. In 380, Anacaust raided Arinthia by sea, decimating their merchant fleet and driving the oligarchy to its knees, a sign of King Zalman's general approach to diplomacy and perhaps some revenge for the defeat that Arinthia had dealt out to his mother. However, King Zalman made one significant alliance with another realm, that of Gesh, famous for its weapon makers. In many ways, this was the key event in his reign. The weapon makers of Gesh. Gesh was a small, fiercely guarded mountainous realm not far from the northern borders of Anacaust, somewhat sandwiched between Anacaust and Arinthia, but tucked away high in the mountains. Gesh's fame and riches came from its extraordinarily crafted weapons and armour, which were greatly sought after by those of a military cast of mind right across the world below the war in the heavens. There's probably a whole podcast about the weapon makers for Gesh just waiting for me, and I'm making a note to myself right now to do just that. But for now, I'm more interested in the relationship between Zalman the Vicious and the unsurpassed craftspeople of Gesh. By the time Zalman had ascended the throne of Anacaust, Gesh already had a reputation as the source of extremely fine weaponry and armour. Their weapon makers apparently had access to ore that made steel that was lighter and harder than any other on the continent, but it was their secret methods that made their arms and armour so prized, methods that were guarded zealously. Perhaps for strategic reasons, or perhaps simply because he coveted unique weapons, King Zalman was keen to monopolise the output of the weapon makers of Gesh. He tried negotiations, but his negotiating style tended to lean simply toward demanding a monopoly, and the weapon makers would have none of that. They preferred an open market where competition would drive their prices up. The mysterious advisers of the Potent Edge were in favour of an alliance of sorts with the weapon makers of Gesh, and it was their recommendation to offer the Geshians something that they had great trouble sourcing, heavenly scales. The most sought-after weapons and armour throughout the continent were made by embedding scales in one way or another. It was painstaking and difficult work, but armour properly bonded with high-quality scales was virtually impervious to damage. Weapons edged with scales, something that demanded great skill and the most intricate methods, almost never shattered, their edges never dulled, and they were capable of shearing through ordinary armour as if it were poor-quality cotton. The weapon makers of Gesh were almost religious in their dedication to their craft, seeing it as an end in itself, a search for perfection in this world. Their methods were so exacting that they often rejected items they'd spent months on, scrapping them as not up to their standard. Making a profit with that sort of approach was, as you can imagine, difficult. They were capable of making scale weapons and armour, but their access to the heavenly scales was limited before Zalman came along anyway. When a caravan from Gesh arrived in Anacaust in 381, King Zalman summoned the lead merchant and gave her a letter with a special commission, a complete set of armour, mail, helmet, shield, the rest, and a sword of the highest quality, all embedded with scales of the finest, most worthy kind, all supplied from Zalman's personal supply. The payment would be scales of equal number, size and quality as those embedded in the commission. The weapon makers couldn't resist the challenge. A year later, in 382, the finished product was brought to Anacaust and unveiled. King Zalman was said to have been both dazzled and satisfied enough to have actually smiled. This began a strong relationship between Anacaust and Gesh, or at least between King Zalman and Gesh. He was granted first refusal on the output of the weapon makers in return for a substantial discount on scales. The result was that the Anacaustian armoury began to be filled with arms and armour of unsurpassed quality. The palace guard were fitted out first, and in brilliant form were fit to guard heaven itself. The most favoured and experienced officers in the army were next to be granted the extraordinary kit, and when they rode into battle, the enemy quailed and their own troops rallied at the sight. The arrangement with the weapon makers was of great satisfaction to King Zalman, but his cruelty brought it to an end. In 384, a year before his death, he felt that the weapon makers were passing off second-best equipment and sending better weapons to rivals like Kildare and the far northern nation of Vesbesili. The lead merchant from Gesh at the time begged to differ, a dangerous approach, and he may have suggested that Zalman wouldn't know first-quality weapon work if it bit him, an even more dangerous approach, as he found when he was dragged to the dungeons and executed. All supply from the weapon makers of Gesh to Anarchist immediately ceased. King Zalman raged and threatened the Geshians, but to no avail. Many items from the weapon makers disappeared after the reign of King Zalman, broken up for the scales and sold. Some items are still in the Anarchistian armory, but unlike in Zalman's time, they aren't for everyday use, being kept for special ceremonial occasions. The Barassus Expedition. The Barassus Expedition is a little bit of joy in an otherwise fairly joyless reign, and this is probably because King Zalman really had very little to do with it apart from being one of a number of prospecting expeditions he authorised and paid for during his time on the throne. I've cobbled together my account of the Barassus Expedition from some good recent texts. A.J. Sperling's The Barassus Expedition, published 2006, and Helena Ponsonby's The Doomed Expedition, published in 2010, plus a somewhat old but hugely entertaining historical novel, Strange Pursuits, from Collier Emmett, published way back in 1930. Expeditions were ostensibly sent into the inland in search of heaven falls, but each expedition commander was charged with scouting for good land thus far uncharted, with the outlook of becoming essentially outposts or colonies, which would extend Anarchist's reach. Some found heaven falls, none very grand. One began a settlement in the valley of the Fregenoska River, which did well for some 50 years before dying out in the Great Drought of 402, and only one had the riotous and legendary history of the Barassus Expedition. The Barassus Expedition of 379 was headed by Vasque Barassus, a friend of one of King Zalman's cronies at the time. He was appointed to command the expedition mostly because King Zalman had sent out 12 expeditions in that year and 8 the year before, which meant that experienced commanders were thin on the ground, so to speak. Barassus's sole qualification appeared to be the boast, while drinking, that he had never been lost, not once. The fact that he'd never set foot outside the capital was a detail that wasn't relayed to the king, who was impressed by the bravado, if nothing else. It was said that Barassus was as astonished as anyone when he was handed the royal commission, but knowing that declining a royal request was a poor way to continue living, he accepted and then went and got very, very drunk. Drink, as we shall see, played a large part in the ups and downs of the Barassus expedition. The expedition, being under royal patronage and authorisation, was well equipped and numbered around 100 strong. Barassus, understanding that nothing was to be gained from diffident leadership, rode at the head of the company with a distinctive red plume in his wide-brimmed hat. He took the expedition north and west initially, then more northwards, after a week of easy going. He confided to his seconds-in-command, four experienced prospectors he was canny enough to employ, that he had glimpsed a map in the library of one of Anarchist's more successful merchant families, a map that pointed to a hitherto unclaimed heavenfall in this general direction, a heavenfall of unsurpassed riches. It's safe to guess that his seconds-in-command managed to control their eye-rolling. The Barassus expedition has a number of claims to fame. Not the least of them is the way that Barassus managed to steer the expedition to every town, hamlet, settlement, community, outpost and trading station that had an inn, tavern, alehouse or other maker and or purveyor of alcohol, where, after some time carousing, he would declare with heartfelt earnestness that he wasn't about to fall for the trap of exploring too fast. Steady exploring, with considerable rest periods, were the key to success, according to Barassus, who was an advocate for the medicinal powers of brewed, fermented, and or distilled drink. Through no fault of his own, Vasc Barrasas eventually found himself beyond the reaches of civilization, leaving the last hospitable trading post behind as his party lurched into the true and uncharted wilderness some 200 leagues from the capital of Anaquist, an arid land of intermittent watercourses, dust, and often frighteningly large reptiles. The percipient who Barrasas had employed was Shelmir Orth, and some 2 weeks after leaving civilization behind, while camped for a few days at a spring to one side of a low ridge just ahead of Forbidding Country, she felt the telltale signs of a heavenfall. Casting about, she found it not far away, and a few days' work uncovered what could only be the end of a heavenly needle, broken not far from the eye end, but still as long as three tall people end to end. The broken needle was made of heavenly metal and scaleless, but still worth a fortune. Barrasas immediately ordered a stockade built around the find, and when it was unearthed, he had it broken up while the company constructed dwellings more permanent than the tents that had hitherto been used. A trusted and well-armed party took the first of the needle pieces back to Anaquist and converted it to cash, which, under Barrasas's orders, was used for the sorts of equipment and provisions needed for a permanent settlement. This included seeds, farming gear, and brewing and distillery equipment, indispensable for a genuine community, at least in Barrasas's eyes. Once the putative defences were erected, the nascent community went about the serious process of having a good time. Soon travellers from hundreds of miles away were changing plans and showing up just in time for opening hours, which tended to be a flexible and responsive concept. When funds ran low, a new chunk of the heavenfall was dispatched to civilization and turned into enough cash to continue what was essentially a continuous party. Numbers in the settlement swelled to something over 1,000. Where most heavenfall colonies would be watchful and suspicious of strangers, Barrasas's settlement was welcoming. Naysayers waited for what they thought would be an inevitable raid or conquest, but it didn't occur. Then they predicted internal strife would bring down the community, but it didn't happen either. Indeed, even after the last heavenfall chunk left, even after the last funds came back, the settlement staggered on, full of bonhomie and cheer, a testament to the better angels of our nature. Eventually, no funds coming in meant no more supplies. The arid area wasn't suitable for farming or agriculture, and so the people of the settlement gradually left, one by one, until Barrasas and a few close friends were the only ones remaining. Declining the romantic option of ushering everyone else away and remaining as the last person in the happiest hamlet until he died, Vasc Barrasas and his friends packed up, returned to Anaquist in 384, and with the little gold he'd kept aside, he bought a ramshackle inn in Lowtown called the Heady Grape, and he restored it. It became a legendary place of good merriment and conviviality, much renowned, where a splendid time was guaranteed for all. Personal life. I've decided that the important historical and cultural events in each monarch's life have tended to overshadow them as people, so I'm going to try to implement a section in each episode devoted to the Anaquistian monarchs, where I explore them as people as much as possible. Of course, for these early monarchs, where the records are relatively scanty, I won't have much to go on, but I'll do my best in plucking relevant tidbits from the sources I do have. For Zalman the Vicious, as for the other monarchs in this nightmare period, sources are even more meagre, with their authoritarian crackdown on just about everything. One possibly unreliable, possibly very reliable source that has come down to us for this period is graffiti. Scrawlings on walls in places that were hidden, basements and foundations of buildings, where the Anaquistians may have felt that they could express themselves with less danger. In the nightmare period, carrying placards in the streets outlining grievances or displeasure certainly wasn't the way to endure a long and healthy life. Zalman's moniker, the Vicious, had currency during his reign and may have possibly come from graffiti. He adopted it, though, with cold relish and was proud to have it bruited about. Other graffiti noted that he was bloody, rabid, cutthroat, and insane. We have instances where other charges are laid at him, including that he was humourless, thieving and pox-ridden. But these are fairly generic allegations, and I think we can place little store in them. One letter exists from his daughter Io to a friend in Orenthia, which is probably why it survives. This letter appears to have been written after her father's death, and she remembers her childhood in the palace before she was sent to a life in the temple. It's mostly minor anecdotes about birthdays and other celebrations, but among them, she notes her father's fondness for birds. Now, fondness isn't a word that many people use in relation to Zalman the Vicious, but apparently he was fascinated by our feathery friends and had bird baths and feeders erected in one of the garden courtyards of the palace, one where he could watch from a balcony. According to Io, this was his solace, a time of quietude, where he could retire for contemplation. He even liked the feral pigeons that infested the capital and continued to infest it in the present. He had a number of people executed for treating birds poorly, and he refused to eat poultry of any kind. Some other aspects of his personality. He was always conscious of duty and responsibility. He was personally brave in battle and never shirked a position at the head of his army, and he was abstemious, preferring plain food and water to the luxurious dishes that would have been available from the palace kitchens. It could be imagined that Zalman's rule of iron would lead to some tension over his mother's plans for the succession. However, in the later years of his life, when necessarily his mind would have turned to this matter, despite some coolness in 380, he did issue a proclamation acknowledging that his brother Yefin would take the throne upon his death. No record exists of whether his twin daughters were at all peeved by this, and the thoughts of his wife are likewise unrecorded. Zalman was described as tall and well-built with broad shoulders from his years of training with weapons. His portraits on coins show him to be good-looking in the typical Anaquistian manner, and he has curly hair and a close-cropped beard, but his demeanour is mostly described as severe. Given this severe demeanour and his actions during his reign, it might sound surprising that he married only once and remained with Leonora Ashenless for the rest of his life. They had twin daughters, Io and Cleo, and from an early age Zalman had them cloistered in the temple. When grown, they took holy orders and served with distinction in the prime temple in Anaquist, well away from the business of succession. As ironic deaths go, Zalman's was right up there. Even in his later years, he rode out with his army and border patrols. In 385, at the age of 63, he was still vigorous and healthy, and so when news of wilderness raiders causing havoc in the north, to settlements on the river Inman, in the north of the realm, he took charge of a division, some 800 to 1,000 troops, and rode to deal with this threat. In the wooded country, however, pausing to hunt, he was surprised by one of the giant razor birds and disemboweled, no doubt shocked at how his beloved birds could turn on him like that. His body was returned to the capital and lay in state, while every noble filed past to pay their respects, fearful that even in death Zalman might strike them if they didn't do the right thing. Final words. Zalman the Vicious was his mother's son in so many ways, most of them violent. And that's it for episode 24 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. Coming up next, King Yefin the Bloody. Until then, farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.